approximately the same level of the PS2 support. Our first rule for me was the problem I fixed in the bike build is something I won't hear the user complain about. So it's actually less work for me to fix problems in the bike build because, well, dealing with PRs or user bug reports is generally more work. Part of that is the second rule. When something doesn't work in the bulk build, I have a pretty restricted environment and an environment that's easy to reproduce. So if something fails in the bulk build, very easy for me to actually reproduce and to start to trace down the breakage. Some of the issues are more interesting, like what versions are involved, and that's, you have to ask someone questions to figure that out, and it's work. So if it fails in a bulk build, that's nice because it's easy to work with. Binary packages generally were not the main focus because originally most of the users have been using source builds anyway, so having binary packages is nice, but it was not the main requirement. So that should explain some of the ideas. So basically, get reproducible builds, and try hard to make it easy to analyze why something is failing. So, for example, one of the problems with the old build environment is when something goes wrong, when did it go wrong? Did it go wrong during the actual compile phase? Did it go wrong during the install phase? Sometimes not very easy to separate the two if you have a 2 megabyte log file of the build output and other things like that. So what do you have to do if you want to run a bulk build? Of course, first you have to set up a machine and you have to set up a bulk build. It's not as easy as the first seems. And if I look back at the emails on the list, I have one or two problems with more than once. So saying that it's very easy to do the setup, no, it isn't. And it's, over time, new issues happen, and if you don't follow some steps that are not really documented anywhere, you can run into very, very strange problems that are actually hard to reproduce. Of course, next you have to actually prepare a package source tree. This might be as simple as running a CVS checkout. It can be more complicated if you want to have specific branches. If you know that specific commits are actually broken, and keep it in mind. Next, of course, the system somehow needs to identify what should actually be done. So what should I do? After that, it must build packages. What did fail or did not fail? And for official builds, of course, we have to send the results somewhere so that people have a chance to look at them. And while we have these binary packages, let's put them somewhere in theory people might want them as well. So what specific problems have I run into over the years? One big issue was what happens if you have stray directories in user package. Basically, they hide big errors because well, if a directory is always there, packages are written to assume that they are there, And well, they will fail mysteriously if this directory is now just missing. Why can this happen? The old infrastructure sometimes didn't remove directories. So depending on the order in which packages were built, the directory might exist or not. With adding Destia support, this is an even greater problem because generally no directory exists at all. Yeah, we have something in the infrastructure to do to deal with that, which is the auto mcard deal. I'm not sure what it was called. What? Yes, that's it. Which avoids some of the problems, but it's not perfect because if you actually want to upgrade the program and want to run a print plist, and you need to create some directories before so that it actually installs files in the right places, it won't work. So be careful when using that. A second big issue is what happens if we have some leftover dependencies already installed in the user package. For example, gmake or package config. The old bulk build infrastructure tried to be smart and reduce the overhead of removing and adding packages over time, and just left some packages installed always. Perl is another bulk build example because it depends on Perl. Perl is most of the time just installed, and you have a hard time figuring out when the Perl dependency is actually needed. Another class of issue is message format from getText. You can see this problem on NetBSD because NetBSD has getText included in base, but as soon as you go to a platform like Dragonfly or Solaris or whatever, you will see a huge class of problems because message format isn't in the base system. So unless you have a dependency, you won't get the message catalogs formatted. And this was also partially written by getText being a package that's very early needed and normally was just left around.
Does it mean that packages that need it should be getText so?
Yes, exactly. And for message format, it's normally very easy to decide whether it's needed or not. If the file installs any message catalogs, it will need it. Actually, you could make it a package in warning, but it will fail pretty soon in a bulk build or one of the package catalogs.
So it should be somewhere in use tools.
Yes. No, because at least one horrible exception where you don't need a message format, I think, which is e-links, because it's using its own special version of getText. I don't really know what's so special about it. Basically, they just have a very old getText version included, added some stupid hacks that don't add any real value, but they insist on using it. So. That's why it's difficult to do it automatically.
Okay, so I think the main problem is documentation, that these issues, as far as I know, are not so easy. Somebody to figure out, somebody creates a new package, people shouldn't really know what to look for and what not to look for. And it would be very helpful to have policy and the best practice.
That's what I said was quite a good idea to make it more. Package lint is something you are supposed to run on your package anyway, and there are exceptions, but there are very few of them, and so it might be a good idea.
Yeah, but I think package lint does a good job, but it will never be able to really explain to you the whole idea of your
Sure. Yeah. So another interesting constructs are things like if exists some file. That's actually still in the code in a slightly modified version. So I didn't invent it. Do you want to guess which package this can be found in? Or do you want to guess what it actually does? It tries to determine whether or not Mozilla should include XFT support or not. I mentioned this specific issue because it was a great problem on Dragonfly and with regular XOR. Because that file won't exist by default during the time dependencies are computed for packages. So between the time dependencies are looked for and the time the package is built, you get some interesting order issues. Same problem happened with P5 MathPerry. I just loved this package. It's so horrible in the way it worked. Basically, it was calling into MathPerry, doing a partial build of that package, and reaching over to get some of the things out of that. One of the reasons this is problematic is MathPerry itself depends on X11 support. On Dragonfly never shipped a native X11, so it always had to pull in XOR for that. But of course, XOR wasn't built at that time. So what happened in reality was P5 MathPerry always forced a full rebuild of XOR loops and some other components. That was not fun, especially because it was sometimes failing to do so, and leaving the tree in a somewhat inconsistent state. Another nice problem is what happens if packages want to write to slash /etc?
They broken, I guess, right?
I think so, yes. It happens. You have to, when you set up a byte build, you have to consider whether or not you want to deal with this kind of issues. Another class is if they want to write to slash /home. Major Domo, for example, still wants to do that. I asked a year ago or so if it can be changed to use a more sane default value for the home directory. Never got a reply. Well, it means no binding package for Major Domo for me. But yeah. Basically, what I do recommend for bulk builds is do a bit more work from the administrator. Set up the system so that only specific locations that must be writable are writable. What must be writable, of course, is a package. Slash var should be writable because a lot of software assumes that it can, during the install phase, write things there. PackageDB, of course, has to be writable, and you have to make work object here writable. That everything else can normally be completely read only.
So, do you work with different file systems, or how do you accomplish that?
Yes. This is some part that's where different operating systems need more or less help to actually get this configured. It helps to have a change root sandbox and use either NoFS or other things. You have to do some things by hand. For example, you have to create the users and groups before so that it doesn't try to do that on demand. It would be nice to have a global target for that to reduce the overhead. Generally, what I do for a new bulk build machine is just run a full bulk build, grab over the failed logs, creates user and loops using create user code. And after two or three iterations, all user groups are created until someone adds a new one. But that's not, that doesn't happen so often, so it works.
Have you known about this as long?
No, but maybe I'll come back to that later, or we can cover it in the question and answer part. The last specific issue with old multiple, of course, was it doesn't scale. Basically, even on a fast machine, you need around 10 or more CPU days to do a full bulk build right now. And I'm talking about the quadruple Xeon here. Which is pretty fast, and NetBSD Current has a fast fork, so you can scale this infinitely for the slower machines. That's a problem, and of course, you really need some mechanism to be able to improve that by basically throwing more hardware on it. So, what does PVAT actually consist of? First component is PVAT scan. This is just responsible for scanning package source tree for packages, figuring out what to build. The second component is PVAT resolve, which does nothing more than compute the full dependency tree. Strictly speaking, it's forced, but that's not going to it yet. PBAT build is responsible for the actual byte build itself. There's some small view in PBAT, which is used by PBAT scan to extract information from the package source tree. That could have been placed externally, but just keeping it in the infrastructure makes it easier to keep it in sync with the rest of the tree. Besides that small target, everything that PBAT is using is normal package source logic. The two schedulers, build and scan, are written in C. For two reasons. First of all, if you want to have network access, it's simply not possible to do that in a reasonable way with shell and borg. It's especially not possible to do something like deal with slow clients, failing network conditions, and so on. You would have to do something like one week dash yot something after you computed the dependency tree. Sure, it can be done, but it doesn't deal well with adding a new client or removing a client to do actual work. And the second reason is doing it in C means memory usage goes down quite a bit. Given that all the metadata you have to keep in memory for full byte build is in the area of a megabyte or so, that shouldn't be underestimated. So the result was written in C because that means it can use reference implementation of GUI directly without having to reinvent the wheel. I did write two GUI implementations in other languages already, and it's not something I want to do without a good reason. And the other point, of course, it has to do quite a bit of string comparison and version comparison, so doing it in C helps to actually speed the process up quite a bit. Currently, the upload logic is somewhat overlapping with PBAT build because it was easier to do when people are built, because I already had the full dependency tree. But that will change as some data profile Python manages that. The new port logic itself is completely written on org. So these are the components that actually produce the HTML and text version of the reports. Let's go a bit more into the details of how the scan works. There are two ways to use the scan component. So first is you give it a number of directories to scan. The other version is just ask it to scan the tree, and in that case it will extract the category make files from the top level and ask the category make file to the subdirectory. This is explicitly done using make because it means all the various kinds of magic you can do in this directories will apply. For example, if you want to conditionally comment out the directory, you can actually do that in the make files using all the mechanisms we have available. For example, conditionalizing it on dimensional architecture and things like that. For distributed scanning, it uses a simple push-pull model. That is, on startup, it supports a shell script that can be used to start clients automatically. And clients are basically opening a network connection to the master process, asking, give me a job, okay, here's the job, do the scan, here's the result. What the scan is doing is basically it's calling make pbart index for every packet pair. The pbart index component is doing some of the work like figuring out is this a multi-version package, which dependencies do we have, and putting all this information to standard out so that but scan can collect it. I explicitly decided to use make here and not do something smart like scanning for depends, like for include lines for include and so on. Simply because it doesn't work to take shortcuts here if you want to get the same results later during the build. I might remember you of the Firefox example a bit earlier. Things like that generally are not recognized by easy and fast parsers that don't use make. Calling make, of course, has a problem of having to scan and pass all the make files of package source, and that currently is quite slow. Especially if built-in and pay magic is involved. So running make even in simple make files that pull in one of those cases needs one sort of second on this machine, and it's not so slow. Would be nice to make that faster, but that will generally help. On all use case. Worst case is something like taking a minute or so for some parts like KDE. That's horrible. And the last thing the scan component does is collects all this output, ensures that it is in the order list you get when you build the package list by hand, and it drops duplicate entries. Duplicate entries in this case means two packages with the same name, either using different option sets or coming from different locations. You have to ensure the original order because you want, of course, to have reliable actions when you do parallel scans, for example. And with parallel scans, the second client to ask might be faster than the first, so you need to ensure that you are back in the original one. The second major part is the resolver. What it does is it implements a mix of the algorithm package add and package source are using when you modify the dependency for a package. Basically, it generally tries to do what package add would do if it has all the vital results at hand. So it looks only at the pattern first and tries to pick up a package based on that. It will complain, for example, if the best match would be from a different location than what the dependency indicated. That's generally a mistake. And we had a number of examples from that simply because the location we gave was bogus and didn't match a package at all. And this is also to ensure that we do get consistent results. There are some cases when we can't make sure which package to actually use. And in that case, what the source code would use but at a point. One specific issue to keep in mind here, consider you have a dependency like that, which was the historic way how to get a ghost script interpreter. It was a bit more complicated than that, but it boils down to this. You have ghost script 7.0 and the ESP version is patch level 1 available. Which one should we actually use to resolve the dependency? Make a guess.
The German provided no good ghost script.
Yes, what would package then use? Package 1 would pick GhostScript ESP.
Because it has a higher rush time.
Exactly. And that's one of those cases where you have to be really careful how version numbers are working. It was one of the few cases where it was really a problem. Ultimately, it was solved by just dropping GhostScript ESP because it was only a young one. But this was a problem also for many PHP packages, because many PHP 4 packages would also match against PHP 5. So there were missing the upper boundary in a lot of cases. And even worse, there was a bug in the infrastructure that tries to merge two dependencies where it basically dropped the upper boundary. Of course, if we can't find a dependency, as a list where the dependency should have come from, that's what can be used to do a limited bug build and automatically pick up the missing dependencies, or otherwise complain. I'll come back about one of the issues with this a bit later. The build component, again, is using a push-pull model, which means if you want to add a new client, just start to build it on the client, say, where the server is, and that's it. Can be done fully dynamically, also nice when the machine crashes during a bug build. It finds all the packages that can currently be built because all the dependencies are already built. And it gives a client a package with the highest priority. Dependency order is currently hard-coded, simply to be the number of packages that depend on this package to be built. There's a simple reason for this rule, and not doing it the other way around, like the old bug rule. about starvation issues when you are powering the build. Basically, if you ensure that packages that are needed by other packages are built first, you make it more likely that you don't have dead runtime because packages can't get jobs because everything is waiting for them. This mostly works. There's one issue at the end of the build. At least one really, really huge package tends to be left over, and that's KOffice. I'm not sure why KOffice is pretty much at the end of the build. But given that it needs something like 10 hours or so on my machine to build, that sucks a bit.
KOffice or OpenOffice?
KOffice.
No.
At least at the time it took a lot longer. It might be that it got faster with recent versions. I'm not sure OpenOffice is actually or was included in the builds at that time. I think it was broken, so I haven't watched it lately, so I can't say if the problem magically disappeared. Yes. Yes, I actually considered timing build time for a package and building a list with those build times and using that to reorder builds. Basically, use a combination of how many packages depend on them, how long will they need to build, and how long is the build needing itself, which would also be useful for slow architectures. You can start by just building all the things that are fast to build to get them sorted out. But I haven't found the time to actually do that yet. It's a nice small research project. And I'm not sure it really helps much. I don't have something like 100 emulated VEX machines to do a NetBSD VEX vibe build in a lab. If you are bored, try to set up something like that. It would be interesting. it would actually be a lot faster than doing native vibe builds. So, I think the VEX emulators are having something like 5 to 10% of native speed right now, so it should actually be able to finish in a reasonable time. If you want to do that for the NetBSD 5 release, be my guest. I'll help.
I plan to set up something like that, but I expect that there will be so much failure, so it will be quite fast anyway.
I'm actually not too sure. Well, VEX might be a bit. No, VEX. Well, yes, VEX is a bad example because it doesn't have IEEE map, which will create some breakage. But if you use something like MAX68K or so, which is more normal as architecture, the same applies to it. It's a horrible slow architecture, but easily emulated. So what's going to change? In the next time. I'll have an option to make it easier to restrict the multi-version support. There are two reasons for this. First is we have a lot of packages that simply don't care about it and don't want to play by naming the name. Good example is Blender, which is a graphic tool which is using Python for scripting. It doesn't care that much which Python version it gets, but it needs one of the links against it. So you're apparently getting a lot of warnings about duplicated packages from Blender directory, which can be suppressed that way to actually get this down to something we are interested in. Basically, if something is mentioned to get marketing packages, but for anything else, you don't want to use it. The other reason, of course, is if you want to use, if you want to do a limited part for your own environment, you don't want all the Python versions. You only care for only one, and it's a bit tedious currently to mask all the other versions as incompatible also. I mentioned earlier that people at Wizard push ends can't find dependency. That's currently a hard failure, and well, it doesn't happen very often, and when it happens, it's because someone wasn't paying attention. But it's easy to actually work around using the incremental mode and filtering out those packages that didn't get the dependency resolved. Just something to add. The incremental mode is that is used for the limited packages. Basically, I say, okay, here's a list of package locations, and write a second list where I should look for further dependencies. So, in incremental mode, it tries to resolve all dependencies. It can, and the rest of the entries are still written out. But have dependencies left. And what you can do for a full build is just look for those entries where dependencies are not yet resolved, filter them out and be done. Third item is, as I said earlier, for simplicity reasons, restricted subset is currently computed at the end of Pipart build itself. I should move that out into some auth logic and do it in upload itself, which has a big advantage that you can run upload before the build actually finished. So you can do incremental uploading, which is useful when you run into more architectures. The fourth item is to check bootstrap packages with special attribute and don't try to install them during the build. Normally you want to test that the package is actually installable. It's especially important if you use Destio mode because in that case, for example, the install scripts aren't executed at all. You can't do that for bootstrap packages because well, they are already installed and just taking the handful of them means you still get a binding package, for example, to update. Another thing is if this install test or the deinstall test program fails, you want to remove the package so that the next one will actually try to build it again. At the moment, it will see, oh, there's a binary package. Cool, it's up to date. Nothing to do, success. This directory doesn't make sense in that sentence, but basically, pbarge should be changed to just use directly instead of using libevent. Libevent was used because it provided the same interface to add events, but the limited set I'm actually using in pbarge can be done directly, and Paul either exists on all platforms you care about or can be implemented or can be emulated using select. So it's quite neat. It's not that difficult to do that, it just wasn't an issue so far. Getting rid of the dependency is useful for the next item, which is split the pbarge package as we have it right now into smaller parts. The first one basically provides the bindings and only that. And which is all those always need a full build and have different personalities and default configurations for those doing full byte builds and those just doing a small subset for personal reasons. For example, if you want to do the later, you don't care about upload, you don't care about getting a report mail, and so on. It makes a few things easier to use if you actually distinguish those cases. You did ask about doing builds as root or non-root. The non-root to do official bulk builds is to run people as root, simply because a lot of the packages need to have root privileges, and people itself doesn't care much. They are does care at one point, and it's when you want to do use LST, because in that case it will actually set user to get, or it will call SU to get the builds actually run as that user. But otherwise, it doesn't really care about extended privileges. So at the moment, every package that has tester support will get built that way. What's not done in the scripts by default, because it can't be done in a portable way, is to remount user package only if you are running a tester build as root to detect those cases where packages still want to write to user package. If you do a user tester build, it will run the actual build as that user after it installs the dependencies. And that's pretty efficient to ensure that nothing runs to user package, making it very safe to test. And yeah, that's basically it. Does that answer the question? Okay. So, other questions? Yes?
There have been some complaints that people are hard to configure and set up. I was thinking it would help to have some kind of script, but not because it's a policy built environment.
I've been thinking about that. Setting people up itself, besides actually changing the configuration file, there isn't that much to do. It's installing people into a second prefix and modifying the configuration file. It's not even more difficult than that. What is difficult, the difficult part of the current documentation is also the most difficult part in the documentation of the own part. And that's how to provide a full setup for an official market. If you don't want to do something like that, you can shortcut most of the complications, and it gets a lot easier. Configuration also gets a lot easier if you actually distinguish those two cases, because many of the configuration options simply disappear. So that should help with the documentation. And the other problem, of course, is who's going to help with the documentation? there have been lots of complaints, but no one really coming up, stepping in, and actually helped to improve it, which is a bit sad. It works.
So what systems are trying
to do? Well, the main use for the client server mode is to use multiple secures on the same system. I actually used it also in the past to do the same thing with multiple machines in the open network. The configuration is essentially the same. What I try we write down what is running a packet in ESD.org, which is a relatively clean setup for doing official bind builds, and something that will hopefully be picked up for other architectures or operating systems. And it's doing all this magic with having multiple parallel builds running using a change root for each and so on with a relatively low overhead. Yes. The master itself is not doing any work. You can use the master node itself to compile. I would recommend the second change root for that. But the master itself is just one process and the idle for nothing.
You get around to that
moving
chaos
from package. Yes, it's an inside TXT in root.
Okay.
Everyone with an access to that machine should be able to read that. So there's still some hand waving. It doesn't really describe what's changed in pbarconf based on the simple assumption. Just takes the file and looks inside it. But I think it covers all the steps of the setup. Reference by just look at the DC FS up and so on.
What is the state of the package cluster?
The state is that it's currently still triggering lots and lots of kernel issues. I just wanted to check. So basically, the setup itself is a second iteration. The first iteration was using more Gaussian mounts and so on, which puts a lot more pressure on the BFS tree. We removed that in the second iteration. Now it's just using lots and lots of mount points. Quite a bit of TabFS, but otherwise not using that much magic. But it's still hanging pretty fast when we actually put load on it. But those are netlist economy issues.
Hardware or software? Hardware or software?
We're pretty sure that the hardware issues actually have been solved by the upgrade of and the CPUs. So
is someone looking at the
kernel issues? Eddie is at least aware of them. We are regularly pinging and mailing them with all the pressures. So hopefully NetBSD 5 will have all those issues fixed and got lots of builds for packages then. When we still had some lock-to-back kernel running, when the first build started with the lock-to-back kernel, it had created something like 2.5 gigabyte of binary packages before crashing first in a bit over or under 2 days. Given the overhead lock debug currently has, that's quite fast. So hopefully a full byte build with an NetBSD 5 release kernel will be done in 2 days or so.
Is your
N64? Yes. I386 should be on at the same time, but it doesn't change much. It should be using the same machine and setup, basically just with some magic to change the kernel identification with the cable or whatever, and otherwise no other changes.
Does that describe
parts, like for example the file system layout, which was not described in this document because it's obvious when you are on the machine, but yes, it will be made more public, and hopefully some of you will help to so that you can actually put it in the guide or whatever.
Will people be replacing the old bulk code framework, or will that be removed at some point in favor of people?
I don't know. Manual and Switch. Harvard is still using the old bulk code, I think.
That's
pretty
large scale.
I think most of the issues with one of the PSD releases are now fixed.
That's why I stopped doing it. That all did not work and the new one was not documented, so I didn't care trying to understand it.
Yeah.
This one, it wasn't actually that hard to set up, but you know,
probably not, but I did not really have the energy and time to try to find information. So if I had not made the set, copy this config file, then I should continue. But
well, actually that part existed, but it seems no one actually looked into patch source docs, so...
It did not exist at the time the old one stopped working.
That might actually be, not sure. I haven't used the old part code for a long